always important to understand there's not just one approach, right? There's a time for coaching, there's a time for managing, there's a time for leading, and there's a time perhaps for discipline. And you know, those different things, there's not one unique style. We as leaders have to understand what situation we need to use what particular style, be able to be flexible, to be able to accommodate that.
Welcome to the Super Managers Podcast, where we interview leaders from all walks of life to tease out the habits, thought patterns, learnings, and experiences that help them be extraordinary at the fine craft of management. Our goal is to bring you the lessons and the insights so that you don't have to learn through your own mistakes, but so that you can shortcut your way to being a great leader. This podcast is brought to you by Fellow, a software platform that helps managers and their teams collaborate on meeting agendas, track action items, and turn chaotic meetings into productive work sessions. Check it out at www.fellow.app. Hey, fellow managers and leaders, I'm Aiden, and I'm the CEO of Fellow.app. Today's guest is none other than John Weigelt. He's the National Technology Officer at Microsoft Canada, and he works closely with government, education officials, healthcare communities. John plays a key role in implementing Microsoft strategic policies and technology efforts across the country. Prior to this, he worked for the Department of National Defense, and was even the Senior Director of Architecture, Standards, and Engineering at the Treasury Board of Canada. He's a TEDx speaker, and in this episode, we talk a lot about the goals of management and how to get the most out of people. We talk about how to use gentle nudges and specific words of feedback to get your teams to be at their best. John's an expert on AI and innovation, and one of the things that he has a unique purview on is this concept of getting organizations to make changes, especially after they've been doing things a certain way for a long period of time. So I was very curious to get John's insights on how to make that happen. So that's one of the things that we spend a lot of time on in this episode. This episode is really wide-ranging. We talk about everything from working with teams to innovation and even improv. I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. So without further ado, here's John Weigelt on episode 31 of the Super Managers Podcast. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
John, there's a lot of stuff that I want to talk to you about. And you've had a really interesting background in that it's been very wide-ranging. You've obviously taught in higher education. You've worked in government. And now, obviously, you're the National Technology Officer at Microsoft. And you've actually played that role for quite a while. I take it that you really like this job.
Oh, I absolutely adore my job. I have the best job in the world. I get to wake up in the morning and talk to Canadians about technology. And it's just something that hopefully my enthusiasm for that comes through in the conversation.
Yeah, no, definitely. So I'm going to rewind, though, before we start talking about your leadership in the current position and things you've learned. I just want to dial it back and look at, you know, when you started your career and who has been your most memorable or favorable, or maybe the boss that you've liked the least, or someone that you remember the most. And what have you learned from that?
Well, you know, I don't remember my boss when I started on the ice cream bicycle, but I think the first boss I really remember was when I was in the military. Coming out of school and working in National Defense Headquarters, an individual, Pat Power, was my boss at the time, and he was so calm and collected. And if you can recall, you know, back when the Gulf War was there, there was a great partnership between industry and government. And sometimes equipment, computers were provided on simply a conversation. And so Pat and I were responsible for putting in place the contracts in order to support all those things. And so his wit that he had as well made this very, very pressing type of environment, something that was manageable. He gave me a lot of room and a lot of latitude. And, you know, whenever he had these records of conversation that really noted if Department X or Organization Y gave us a computer to send out to the Gulf, he'd call it a cheeseburger. And so he'd get these calls, he'd go, John, I got another cheeseburger for you. It just really cut through the tension that was there. And I think, you know, that really stuck with me is calm, collected nature and the ability to bring humor into the workplace.
Yeah, that's really interesting to take a serious situation like that and turn it into something comical that way. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was.
And so if I were to ask you, when did you first start leading a team yourself?
It was shortly thereafter. Started to lead a team of a small group of individuals for computer security, and that grew out to a larger team of some 35 people around the Y2K period. Ever increasing numbers of people, and each requires a little bit of different skill and approaches.
Yeah. And so what did you learn, I guess, during that process, or what kind of lessons did you learn in managing a team early, and what kind of mistakes did you make back then?
Well, I'd love to say that I didn't make mistakes, but I've made quite a few of them. But I think the biggest learning that I had is this idea of better is the enemy of good. You know, you start off and you ask individuals to write a report for you or to do a survey or a study, and then you dive in and you start to polish the stone. And, you know, that can be very, very disheartening if they keep coming back with redlined information, or they're feeling that, hey, you know, why is the boss always, you know, kind of critiquing my things? And so really having to learn to let go and say, you know what, this is that work, and it is great work. Don't get me wrong. It's great work. And then carry it on. You don't have to put your stamp on anything, on everything, in order to show up properly in front of your boss or in front of the mission.
Yeah. I'm curious, how do you balance that in terms of like making sure that, you know, quality is good? Is it very situational that, you know, for some things, quality good enough is good, and other places, perfect is good?
Yeah, you're indeed correct. It's very situational. It depends on the particular work item there that you have before you. You know, I get the great opportunity to work with startups and innovators. And the hardest challenge that you have is, what is the minimum viable product? And so you start off with this really fantastic idea around a new-to-world product or service, and you've got all the bells and whistles. But that might take you 5 years to build out, and you don't have that resource to be able to do that. So can you scale that back to say, today I'm going to ship this, and I know that it's going to have some rough edges, but we'll get a sense of how we can evolve this and meet the marketplace. It's really kind of an art form to be able to get to that. And sometimes it really just takes some experience, learning those lessons of saying, you know what, that one's taking too long, or hey, that was released too early.
Yeah, startups are kind of something that I've been involved in for a long time. And I get the sense for like the minimum viable product that it's much more about, you don't have to get all the functionality, but the things that you do decide to focus on, that making sure to get those really right. So they're high quality, but maybe in less places. Not everything is great, but the things that are the most important, those parts work really well.
Well, and that's where those initial customers or initial feedback is so important, right? So you want those initial consumers of your product to be tolerant and to be able to say, look, hey, if only it would do this, or yeah, we're okay that we've had this hiccup, and they'll work with you. So it's really establishing that partnership between you and your team and then the end consumer.
Yeah, that makes sense. So just to talk about kind of those early lessons, I'm curious, so how did it come that you ended up learning that lesson of, you know, trying to basically, it sounds like you might have been doing a little bit of micromanaging back then and making sure that everything was perfect quality. I guess, like, what are the downsides of going about it that way and trying to make things higher quality? Because, you know, I think of famously Steve Jobs worrying about like every little detail and how chips were laid on, you know, a circuit board and things that people would never see, and like emphasizing quality from that perspective. How did you end up learning the lesson that you did?
So it's a great question. I think it's all about the people. Management, leadership, coaching is all about the people and getting the best out of people. Getting that feedback or seeing kind of those nonverbal cues from people that come to you made me snap and pay attention to say, look, you know, hey, this comes back and forth, and people aren't really happy to doing that. And what can happen is you fall into a trap where people start to give you lower quality work because they say, you know what, oh, forget it. The boss is just going to revise it anyways. And once you start to notice that, you say, well, am I getting the best out of my team? And am I making the most out of my work? My work is not to redo the team's work. My work is to provide them gentle nudges, gentle guidance, so that they can perform their best work. Some of those early days when I started to see a steady decline in the reporting or in those things, I needed to snap to attention and say, yeah, that's that can't continue on. I'm spending far too much time on this. The team is not happy with me. Let's find a new way.
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting way to look at it. And yeah, it dives into the human psychology of the boss having too much feedback sometimes.
Yeah, exactly.
I take it that a large part of your role today in what you do as the National Technology Officer at Microsoft, I mean, you obviously mentioned that you talk a lot with startups, but it sounds like you also talk a lot with bigger corporations and governments. And, you know, a large part of what you do is convince people that they need to change. And, you know, the status quo isn't where, you know, things should stay. That's a really hard thing to do, to convince people that they need change. I'm curious, what have you learned over the course of time that has made you more successful at convincing people of that?
I wish I was even more successful at convincing change, right? In Canada, Deloitte found in the report Canada 175 that Canadian business wants to maintain the status quo. You know, we find ourselves in Canada having an even bigger challenge to try to get people to adopt new things. So change is hard. Change is something that people try to avoid. It really comes down to the people. As much as we talk about digital transformation or technology innovation, it comes down to people wanting to do things differently, people being comfortable with it. Telling people that they need to change doesn't really help, right? It's those gentle nudges, you know, giving people nudges and stepping them along the way, or telling stories and great storytelling. Before we came on the call, we were talking briefly about the Heath Brothers and Made to Stick, and telling anecdotal stories or things that people can digest is important. Making things digestible. You know, how can I explain technologies in ways that are tactile, so to speak? You know, we talk about cloud computing or machine learning, and people often find that, hey, these are difficult concepts to grasp. So can I find a simple anecdote or metaphor that helps people understand this a little bit better? And then give them those concrete examples that would help their business. And one of the biggest learning things that I do, or learning paths that I'm always taking, is trying to really fundamentally understand the business and the business models of those people I speak with. You know, when you look at different coffee vendors in Canada, some are very throughput. So, you know, it's commodity, it's quantity, quantity, quantity. Some are experienced type coffee vendors. And so understanding kind of those levers then can help you have a more informed conversation, and then take people along the journey. I've often seen people say, you know, it's not pushing people to a particular conclusion. It's take my hand, let me help you. Come on this journey with me, and I will share then what could be.
Yeah. So it sounds like storytelling is a very, very important part of the process. And, you know, I take it like leaders should be good storytellers. And then secondly is really, really understanding, you know, who you're talking to and deeply, and putting yourself in their shoes.
Absolutely. And it's also, you know, asking yourself the question, what's in it for them, right? So as you're having this conversation, even as a leader, as a salesperson or in customers, it's always, so what drives this person? What motivates this person? Is it self-fulfillment? Is it financial remuneration? Is it recognition? Like, what are those particular things that really jazz somebody about the work that they're doing, or jazz them about the work that they do? And then trying to then position things in a way that fits with what's in it for them.
Yeah. And I think this is obviously has a lot of transfer learning for not just organizations to change, but departments to change, people to change, teams to change. Understanding them, what's in it for them, is a very important part of the process.
It is indeed. Another piece that can also tie into this is to be able to have those champions that are well-regarded within your community. So you might have a team member that's a champion, kind of that unspoken leader, or you might have a champion outside in an organization that's looking for change. And it's finding those champions and nurturing them, because often change can be done far more rapidly, far more efficiently when it's done outside an organization than when it's trying to be done inside an organization. And so what I mean by that is we've seen in some government departments where they've created innovation labs or innovation centers that are a little bit outside of the normal line of business. They can try out things there, see how they work, build that innovation muscle, and then bring that into the organization. And we've seen that be successful at places like Transport Canada, Ontario government. I've even seen it at a small restaurant in Regina where the restaurant owner bought a food truck so that he could innovate with his recipes without upsetting his normal clientele. And so he was able to innovate, try things out, and then fail fast to be able to incorporate those lessons.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting, because obviously the organization is all about having a process and continuing with the process. And sometimes that extra tension is probably not worth it, and it makes sense to do that elsewhere.
I think so. And I think as well, it helps then open the horizons of some of the senior leaders within the organization. You know, how many times have we heard about the Kodak company and trying to position a digital camera as the future inside the senior leadership? And senior leadership said, well, hey, we sell film. right? Not cameras. And so, you know, how do you then be able to have a more informed conversation? Well, perhaps it's through creating those incubation centers and then taking those lessons in to be able to land that perhaps more concrete fashion.
Yeah. I wanted to dig in on this thing that you just mentioned, which is sometimes it makes sense to convince champions or basically build champions within an organization. I think you're right that when you get, say, if you get parachuted into an organization and all of a sudden, or a department or a team, and it's really hard to convince everybody, you know, identifying key people that could convince everybody else, it seems like, you know, the bowling pin analogy, like if you can get some players to be the champions, maybe they can do the rest of the work for you.
Absolutely. I think that's the champions will understand the organizational culture. They'll understand the friction that's there, and they'll be able to then help you along your journey. One of the lessons that I was learned early on in the military, because you get posted around quite a lot, right? So every 3 years, you tend to get a new job. And I learned this from the senior non-commissioned members. It was, you know, you come into a new job. First of all, you take the senior non-commissioned member under your wing and you say, please teach me how this organization works. And you might have some observations very early on. Hey, this seems to be broken. This seems to be broken. This seems to be broken. They reminded me, write that on a sticky note, put it in your top desk drawer. And at the time, they said, in 90 days, pull out all these sticky notes and say, this will work, and I can change this or I can't change that. The pace might have changed a little bit, but I think the lesson there is important, is to really grab your bearings, orient yourself and say, okay, so who are my champions? What are those initiatives that I can champion? So that I cut a path through the forest instead of trying to cut down all the trees, and then go on that journey. Because I think sometimes what happens is you'll have strong leaders, strong managers come into new organizations and they'll put up their elbows and say, well, when I was here and so, I did all these things. And that can then backfire on some of the team members when they say, well, hey, the new person is here now just trying to shake things up. And it makes people really, really uneasy. And uneasiness is a destroyer of organizations. Like, that uncertainty of what's happening is just nastiness. And so if you're able to provide certainty in the immediate term, and then pick your spots as you move along, that helps that graceful transition as new leaders come in or as new initiatives come.
So along those lines, and you kind of hinted at it, was in saying that organizations sometimes, in order to innovate, they might need to create these labs or these separate places where they can innovate basically, you know, outside the norms and processes of the main organization. I wanted to dig a little bit more into innovation since it's so much of what you live every day. You have this term called improv in the workplace. I'd love for you to explain that to us and why that's relevant to innovation.
Sure. So a good friend of mine, Andrew McMurtry, made a go of trying to put improvisational tools, so those things that the Comedy Network does or comedians do, into the workplace. And improvisational tools are really our ability to keep a conversation going and build upon the ideas of other. And so one of the taboo words is no. You don't say no. It's yes, and you build upon that idea. And so you end up in this really great environment where you build upon others' ideas. It's a very inclusive conversation. So you're grabbing ideas from everybody around the table and you're snowballing it. I like to call them fast neuron conversations. And so you're able then to say, hey, you know, this and I can go here and I can go there and I can go there. We've all been at a meeting where an idea is presented. Somebody gets up the courage to finally present their idea, put themselves out there. Then someone says, nah, that's just dumb. Well, what happens, right? You know, the body language would just, they'll just retreat and you might not hear from them for the rest of the meeting, and, you know, hurt feelings and whatnot. And it might've been a great thing. And so improvisation allows you to snowball on those ideas. It allows you then to be creative and be open. It really helps you open your mind to everybody's concepts and everybody's ideas. And certainly within Microsoft, we've found that having diverse conversations, and I mean diverse in the full sense of the word, from different backgrounds, different ethnicities, different religions, different orientations, really helps us create better solutions because we can hear from the entire community. And improv lets you do that. It gives you that muscle, those tools to be able to do that.
So that makes a lot of sense. And you know, another way that I've also heard that explained is, it's not to say that won't work because, you could instead say that could work if.
Absolutely.
And just find, you know, a way to, yeah, like build on each other's ideas. I think that makes a lot of sense. One question that I wanted to ask is, like, you know, it's obviously, we always talk about it's hard to get people to change or organizations to change. Part of that is because probably on an individual level, you know, when we look at ourselves, it's also hard for ourselves to change. Are there any tips or tricks or or things that you would tell people on an individual level to understand that they need to change or get themselves to change and not like keep doing the same things or making decisions in the same way that they always have?
Yeah, that's, you know, change is hard. And if you're not familiar or comfortable with making changes on a regular basis and reminding yourself to be open to change, then you can get stuck in a rut. And so I think, first of all, it's the mindset. It's, you know, getting into that frame of reference in your own mind that, hey, change is continual. And how do I continue to put that change out there? I try to be bold and vulnerable, put myself out there, put out ideas and try new things. Now, I've got the great fortune of, hey, I need to understand the breadth of Microsoft solutions and products. And I also get put in front of audiences from high school students all the way up to the CEO of a bank. Really, you get out there and you have to represent yourself. So there's a lot of learning that happens along the way, and learning helps you with that change. And then afterwards, it's being self-critical. And seeking that feedback and seeking that input from others and saying, you know what, how'd that really go? And being direct about it. Everybody can say, well, hey, that presentation, you knocked it out of the park. Well, yes, great, but how could I improve? You know, where were the wincing moments, or where did you feel that, you know what, I lost the audience or that? And so it's being that self-critical as well.
Hey there, before moving to the next part of the interview, quick interjection to tell you about one of the internet's best kept secrets, the Manager TLDR newsletter. So every 2 weeks, we read the best content out there, the greatest articles, the advice, the case studies, whatever the latest and greatest is, we summarize it and we send it to your inbox. We know you don't have the time to read everything, but because we're doing the work, we'll summarize it and send it to your inbox once every 2 weeks. And the best news, it's completely free. So go on over to fellow.app/newsletter and sign up today. And with that said, let's go back to the interview. You know, one thing that, you know, I have to talk to you about, you know, given your role at Microsoft and also just how often you come across AI and AI in the workplace and how things are changing towards that end. You know, a lot of the things that I usually hear leaders say is, well, organizations are really hard because people are really hard, and people aren't really, you can't manage people. It's not a science. It's somewhat of an art. And so I'm just curious, like, if we move forward into the future, say 5-10 years into the future, what role do you think AI will have in helping managers manage their teams?
That's a great question. And I think, you know, there's a lot of misperceptions out there around AI and AI taking over or displacing individuals. And so, you know, AI is going to complement and enhance human creativity. At the end of the day, leaders want to get the most out of their people. And so I look at leadership as being something that is very compassionate, is very person-to-person type interaction, to understand kind of what makes a person drive, tick, and how can I see the best out of the leader, almost into a coaching perspective. Coaches and leaders, a little bit different skill sets. You know, leaders, you know, take my hand, come with me on this journey. Coach, you know, you have to conduct this play, but I know you, I'm going to get the most out of you. Managers, a little bit different type of skills, right? Looking at the metrics that you're putting out, looking at those scorecards, looking at those types of things. I think AI can complement those scorecarding or those metrics parts that fit into the coaching and the leadership. So for example, being able to recognize that, hey, during your weekly meeting, 90% of your team members are on mail, right? And so instead of being interacting and being engaged, they're doing email. You know, AI can help you with those tools, provide a comfortable work environment where your employees don't feel that Big Brother's watching because they're anonymized statistics or they're generalized statistics, things like that. AI can help with, let's say, retail shift management. So if I have a cadre of 100 employees and I have to fill in my shifts, AI can help me better manage that or understand what my capacity is. So there's places where AI fits, but it doesn't take over that human interaction. Again, we are humans. We come into the work environment as social environments. You and I are connecting over this video conference because, hey, it's going to help us have that connection, that interaction. And so AI can't replace that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Enhancing human creativity, like doing a lot of the number crunching, giving you better data, and then helping you make those decisions.
That's right. And it also helps employees as well. So one of the tools that we have internally is my analytics, my workplace analytics. And it tells me, you know, how many hours I worked past the 9 to 5, how many evenings were there? What was my downtime? What was my meeting time? And do I have think time? And so it helps me then learn and adjust my work so that I can get the right work-life balance or, you know, adjust my way of working.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. John, you have this saying that says, embrace the audacities of inexperience. Is it true that you actually have this on your wall somewhere?
I did. When I had a whiteboard in my office, I had written on the top of my wall. And it was as a counterpoint towards the curse of knowledge, right? So we've all encountered, you know, a computer system that is very frustrating to work, right? Maybe it's a green screen, maybe the application doesn't work as it's supposed to. Maybe it's even something our organization created. And us old timers would say, you know what, you'll get used to it. You'll figure it out. You'll figure out the arcane keystrokes and whatnot. The young person might come in and go, you know what, this isn't good enough. And you say, okay, young timer, you'll learn. And the young timer says, you know what, I'm going to build a new app and fix it. And they'll come out with something fantastic that makes life easy. They'll have the audacity of inexperience to say, I'm not going to put up with the status quo. I'm just going to go off and do these things. I'm going to call the boss, or I'm going to get this project running, or those types of things. And so I see that all the time as we get new people within our teams, new people within our organization, or I get to talk to new people. This audacity of inexperience to me is almost addictive to get these new ideas, these bright new ideas, and then to really try to quash down that status quo that I might have to say, yeah, yes, and what if we could build out on that way? And so, you know, it's important to remind ourselves of that on a reoccurring basis.
So taking that growth mindset and the ability to change, one of the things that, you know, I've heard you say is that when you approach relationships or meeting new people, you always come from this learning framework. So I'd love for you to elaborate on, you know, what that means. What does it mean to have a learning mindset in working relationships?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's something that I exercise on a repeated basis, and I remind myself of all this before I go into the sessions, is remind myself that, look, I have the great fortune of working with some very advanced technologies, and I talk about them all day long. And so, for example, cloud computing. We hear about cloud computing. It's now almost ubiquitous. I got to work for that for 10 years. But the person that I meet might just have this new exposure to it. And so what can I learn from that person as I have this conversation and recognize that I have something to share, they have something to share. And sometimes people have said to me, John, you've gone to this Chamber of Commerce meeting in this small community. Why did you do that? I said, well, I've got a great opportunity to learn from that opportunity. Or if I got talked to high school students, you know, high school students and even elementary students ask the toughest questions. And so you get that unadulterated quest for knowledge, and it helps then you think about things in a different fashion. The last piece is, as a funny story is, I went to the Chamber of Commerce in Whitby, Ontario, invited in to speak about innovation, technology innovation. And some people would say, well, John, why are you going into Whitby? And I said, well, I get to talk to the business.
Whitby's a small place, right?
It's a small place.
What's the population?
Oh, I'm not even sure it's 100,000. It's pretty small. But people ask, well, John, why did you go in there? And I said, well, I get to hear from small businesses. I get to hear their challenges. I get to hear what is on their minds. And at the same time, I met Ryan Smolkin, the CEO of Smokes Patin. And oh my goodness, the messages that he shared around his journey to become a global brand for a Canadian startup was just tremendous. And to hear his mindset in that. So, you know, going into these opportunities, that learning mindset might give you that serendipitous collision of ideas. And I found on a repeated basis, if I can do that, then, hey, that enlightens the conversations, that enlightens the stories, and that helps me then position where I do my learning.
You know, I think that makes a lot of sense in the way that you're describing it and in your role. But I also think within organizations, just having those sorts of conversations, talking with, you know, all employees, not just your immediate team, that can provide a lot of value. And like you said, the collisions, the chance happenings, a lot of those sorts of conversations, you don't know what they can lead to. But also, if you don't do it, you might be out of touch with reality.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I found that today's new employees are much more amenable to having those conversations. So they're not shy to say, hey, I want to talk with the president. I want to talk with this person. I want to get a sense of what's on their minds. So they're bold and brash. And that's a really, really cool thing, is to take that opportunity to share your thinking. And then for leaders to make sure you have that opportunity as well. I know that when I first joined at Microsoft, Frank Clegg, who was the president at the time, you know, came in and set some time up with me and had a conversation, said, what's on your mind? How's it going? How, like all those types of things that really demonstrate that strong leadership along with the management skills.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, obviously you work at a mega corporation, government, military, teaching, you know, all these different things. What is your opinion on how leadership differs, or like how your style of leadership differs in each one of these different types of organizations? Or are they all the same?
They are quite dramatically different across organizations. You know, the military is indeed the military, and I've seen different styles across the different domains. So Air Force leaders are different than Army leaders, different than Navy leaders, and each has that that leadership style. And at peacetime or in conflict, you know, that leadership style changes. And so recognizing that it's very situational for the particular mission at hand, so to speak. And so when you're in an operational role, there's far less coaching and far more direction. You know, I need you to do X, Y, and Z. And hey, you shouldn't be questioning me at this point. Whereas in a peacetime scenario, it's like, let's explore and figure out how we can best do this together, right? So there's those dynamics. In the government framework, was more on policy outcomes and longer timeframes. And so where you had something very direct in the military setting, where you would get through half of your conversation and someone would be acting almost before you finish speaking. Government, a little bit more longer timeframes. Because when you think about where I worked in Treasury Board, the policy environment, you want policies to last for 10 to 15 years. So there's detailed consultation. There's a lot of collaboration across the departments. Consensus building is key. And so there's a lot of diplomacy that happens behind the scenes and different leadership skills required for that in order to move things through. Academic setting, the same type of idea. You know, there's a crunch time before the academic year, getting a curriculum set up, and then, you know, much more casual. In the business world, very, very focused on quarterly accountability. And how do we make sure that we act very, very quickly? And how do we make sure we're very customer centric? And so having that tension to say, we need to do what's right for the customer, but recognizing what we can do to help, right? What's on our part of the equation. That said, at Microsoft, there is a huge emphasis on manager excellence. And so I'm quite fortunate that, you know, on a regular basis, they're looking to build our management and leadership skills so that we can have this this better environment for everybody that works here, and really empower them to do their best work. So help everybody really, you know, realize, and it sounds trite right along our mission line, but realize their full potential.
So that's really interesting. I assume there's new manager training, but it sounds like on an ongoing basis, there are things that the company does to ensure that its leaders continue to get better. What are some of the things that you do? You mentioned something quarterly.
Yeah, indeed. So at Microsoft, we've shifted under Satya Nadella from a know-it-all culture to a learn-it-all culture, right? And so there's a great deal of emphasis on learning and getting tech intensity, tech skilling. But part of that is also around making sure that our people can do their best work. So as I mentioned, we want to make sure that we have an inclusive environment. Our goal is that our organization reflects, the employees in our organization reflect our customers. And so we want to have this rich mosaic in the Canadian context or Baltic pot, or, you know, we want to better represent the customers we serve. And so our sense is that really creates better products. And so there's a great deal of emphasis on that and personal commitment that we make to that and learning and education. And so we do have regular learning requirements around diversity and inclusion, around dialogues across differences and other types of courses. And then we have management excellence teams that come with quarterly learnings, with group sessions, with breakouts, and a lot of interaction to talk about sharing skills, much like this podcast, to share experience, to share those skills, to take those lessons, to get tactile experiences, to say, hey, you know what? I felt vulnerable when I did this. You can learn from that in this way. And so that really helps make us better managers, better leaders.
Yeah, no, that's really cool to actually have the shared experiences in that way. It looks like, you know, from your standing point, it sounds like I mean, you have to almost be an optimist because, you know, you look forward to the future. You see all the great things that technology is going to do. You can see that the future is brighter than it is today. I just have to ask you, like, in your opinion, can you be a great leader and be a pessimist?
I don't think you can be a great leader and be a pessimist outwardly facing, right? So I think for your teams, you need to be enthusiastic and you need to be optimistic because we need to be positive about the outcomes that we're making. We all know that when we meet the Eeyores in our teams, you know, they can bring us down and we can't do our best work. And so I think if you're a pessimistic leader, you can never show that to your organization. Can you imagine being the leader in front of a troop that's about to liberate a city and saying, well, I don't think we're going to make it. That's not going to do anything. So you really have to be optimistic and say, hey, gang, we're going to be wildly successful. And then go forward with that and put in place the plans and the processes in order to support that. So never let your team see you sweat or never let your team see that pessimism. I really think you do need to be optimistic and positive.
Interesting. So it's almost like plan as a pessimist, but act as an optimist.
That's probably a good way to put it.
Some variation of that. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So John, we're just coming up on time here and so many great learnings in what we've discussed so far. But one of the questions that we like to ask at the end of every episode is just any advice, resources, tips, books, podcasts, like anything that you would recommend to managers and leaders out there looking to actively work on getting better at their craft of leading people.
Yeah, you know, that's a tough one because I know that there's so many great leaders that listen into the podcast. And so, you know, one of the things that I always try to remind myself is to listen. It's just to be quiet. Right? I tend to be vivacious and I get enthused and I start to talk a mile a minute. And then often that can drown out other people's opinions. And that's quite a shame if that happens. And so as a leader, you know, we need to be patient. We need to listen to what happens, what's on our people's minds. And I think that's a muscle that we can build. There is an organization that helps leaders with those skills called Box of Crayons. And I really encourage people to take a look at that group because they do help you build muscle and reinforce that idea of being patient and listening to your team and catching things out. I think as well, it's always important to understand there's not just one approach, right? There's a time for coaching, there's a time for managing, there's a time for leading, and there's a time perhaps for discipline. And you know, those different things, there's not one unique style. We as leaders have to understand what situation we need to use what particular style and be able to be flexible, to be able to accommodate that. And the last piece is always the people aspect of it. You know, work doesn't keep me up at night, but the people keep me up at night. And I know that sounds kind of odd, but you know, a presentation the next day or a report I have to write, that doesn't keep me up at night. But if there's a team member that's going through difficulty and I'm trying to help them, that is where it is. And so I think it's always, let's come back to the people, our team, and seeing the best out of them.
That makes a lot of sense and a great way to end it. John, thank you so much for doing this.
Well, thank you so much for the invite. Certainly filling some big shoes with your predecessors, the other people you've interviewed. So I really appreciate the opportunity.
And that's it for today. Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of the Super Managers Podcast. You can find the show notes and transcript at www.fellow.app/supermanagers. If you like the content, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe so you can get notified when we post the next episode. And please, tell your friends and fellow managers about it. It'd be awesome if you could help us spread the word about the show. See you next time.